Hello, welcome everyone. This is Dr. Amy Russell. I'm the Medical Director of Mission Health Partners, and we are doing a podcast today focusing on the American Society of Clinical Pathology's Choosing Wisely guidelines. And so we're really interested in how we can be good stewards of healthcare costs, and a lot of that can be found in what we do related to diagnostic testing. I'm here today with Dr. Christopher Craigle. He is a pathologist with Mountain Area Pathology, and I will hand it off to him and let him introduce himself and get started.
Hello, I'm Dr. Craigle. As Dr. Russell mentioned, I'm a pathologist board certified in anatomic and clinical pathology, as well as hematopathology and cytopathology. And today's podcast is going to be centered around pathology's contribution to the Choosing Wisely campaign and how that is manifesting itself in the Mission Health System. I'd like to start out with a little background, speaking broadly on how we got to a Choosing Wisely campaign at all and how necessary that is. So I think it's well known and widely accepted that healthcare delivery in the United States is incredibly expensive, but our outcomes are not always at the top of that same list. So we're on all the wrong lists and all the wrong places. And you can find a lot of alarming statistics to back that up. It's been said that 18% of our economy is spent on healthcare. There was a 2010 Institute of Medicine study that showed that 30% of healthcare expenditures were for unnecessary services. And there are lots of reasons why this could be. Where some have said there's perhaps a culture of more is better. Certainly in my residency training in medical school, you know, a deep consideration of resources wasn't particularly emphasized. So I don't think we're trained to do it. I think there's a culture of more is better. But if you ask physicians and tell me if you think you agree, Dr. Russell, that we kind of recognize that there is waste. Like, we recognize that it is a problem.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And I think we also recognize that physicians are in the best place to see those wasted resources and one of the best place to make recommendations to fix these problems. And so it's kind of with that backdrop that the American Board of Internal Medicine started a very successful Choosing Wisely campaign. And they have picked up over 70 different medical societies. And one of those societies is the American Society of Clinical Pathology, which is one of the major pathology organizations. And their idea was to come up with a list of what is now 35 tests that are of no clinical benefit or only beneficial in very specific circumstances. And this is a particularly good avenue to go down because by volume, laboratory testing is the single highest medical activity there is. And so they very rapidly put together an expert panel, and their goal was to identify tests that are ordered frequently and may not be of clinical value.
Yeah, I think that's great. Thank you. Thank you so much for explaining that. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think about when I think about ordering tests is, for me, I'm blind to how much the cost of the test is. And sometimes it's not easy to figure out actually what the cost to the patient or the cost to the insurance company is. I think having these highlighted through this Choosing Wisely campaign can be really helpful because it highlights not only, you know, avoidable costs, but areas where we may be spending money that may be higher cost of care.
Exactly. And this is an easily, so this list of 35 tests is very easy for anyone to find on the internet through the ASCP's website. Very well worded, it's well referenced, it's very thorough. And so I wanted to take some time just to go through maybe four of the tests on this list that kind of I see in my practice as, you know, I'm the director of the flow cytometry lab at the hospital. And so I do see occasionally, we're pretty good about it, but one of the things on the list is that peripheral blood flow cytometry, which is a test used to identify leukemias and lymphomas, is really not useful in cases of isolated anemia, isolated thrombocytopenia, or mature neutrophilia. In these instances, the likelihood of flow cytometry being useful is extremely low. If you have a patient, though, that has abnormal cells, you know, in the Mission Health system, we call them other cells before a pathologist reviews the slide. Or if you have neutropenia and absolute lymphocytosis, lymphadenopathy, or splenomegaly, these are clinical scenarios that greatly increase the pretest probability that the peripheral blood flow cytometry will yield useful results. And that's important to keep in mind because while flow cytometry is an incredibly powerful tool and is kind of the gold standard in diagnosing leukemia and lymphoma, it's also very expensive. And you really want to be deeply thoughtful in ordering that test. One of the other tests that I run across a lot is MDS-FISH, which is FISH stands for fluorescent in situ hybridization. And the goal here is to try to identify cytogenetic abnormalities that can be diagnostic of myelodysplastic syndrome. But what they found is that conventional cytogenetics, when you're able to grow out 20 cells, is always going to pick up the abnormalities that the FISH identifies. So it's kind of like you're doing the same thing twice. And MDS-FISH involves four probes, and it can be very expensive. And these are abnormalities that are going to be picked up by cytogenetics. So, you know, I would just say if you order a bone marrow and you want to order, this is a very specific situation, but if you order a bone marrow with cytogenetics and FISH, you really only need the FISH for MDS if the cytogenetic study doesn't grow out 20 cells. And this would be an example where this is really oncology driven and pathology driven. So we're always available for consult. And that's another recurring theme of this podcast should be that the pathologists have a really deep understanding of laboratory medicine. And we're always available for consultation to answer any questions about the right test at the right time.
Yeah, that's really helpful. You know, as a primary care physician, these aren't tests that I order. I've heard of them before, but it sounds like these tests are typically ordered by oncologists or potentially hospital medicine physicians. And with this last example that you gave, so if there's additional testing that needs to be done, is there a stepwise approach to ordering tests if you have additional questions and you don't, for example, get the answers that you need from the karyotype, or does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you can have that conversation with the pathologist. You can say, you know, if the for this MDS case, if the karyotype's normal, I would then like to add next generation sequencing, or it just requires a conversation and very specific order comments in the order comments, basically, to make sure that nothing's missed and we're doing everything the clinician wants.
That's another point, a great example.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that is maybe more surgical, general surgery, surgical oncology related is, you know, one of the techniques we use in pathology and surgical pathology is the frozen section diagnosis, where we rapidly freeze something and then we can look at it immediately intraoperatively while the patient is having a procedure. So the whole goal of the frozen section diagnosis is that it needs to affect the decision making intraoperatively. So if the result of the frozen section does not affect immediate patient management, then we greatly discourage ordering a frozen section, because that technique of rapidly freezing the tissue, that technical process does kind of degrade the material and can make the final diagnosis more difficult. It's also fairly expensive and timely and uses a lot of technical staff, but it can also make interpreting the final material more difficult. And so we, you know, avoid, I call them curiosity frozen. Hey, what is this? But it's not going to change my management. Just hold off until for the final diagnosis in that case.
So I know you mentioned that Mission Hospital has a specific approach to this. How are they addressing kind of ordering and the processes of ordering in order to ensure that we're appropriately supporting decision support around ordering tests.
Sure. So just kind of skipping to the next topic. So the HCA has developed a laboratory formulary, which is like you think it is. It's a list of tests routinely available for inpatients, outpatients, and for diagnostic requests post-discharge. And this is a gigantic document. I mean, it's not easily emailed because of its size. So and then they go a step further, and these tests are broken down further into tiers. And the goal of these tiers is to consistently and appropriately utilize laboratory resources. So the tiers are, you have a group of tests that are unrestricted, like your CBC and your BNP. And then next you have limited, which is basically more like tests that have more narrow clinical indications and have to be ordered and interpreted by a subspecialist. And then you have tests in the review category, which are generally genetic tests or other tests that have limited clinical value for inpatient care. So these tiers generally have to do with inpatient care. And they also will have the pathologist, what's called review, because if it's ordered, the pathologist will review the order, have a discussion with the clinical team, and then hopefully can come to a conclusion whether to approve the test or to deny the test. And so the reason behind the turnaround time being greater than 7 days falling into the review category is because we really want to make an effort that on the inpatient side, that we only order tests that are going to come back while the patient's still in the hospital. Because the goal is to order tests that impact care while the patient's still in the hospital. If it's going to come back 2 weeks later, then the argument is that should be ordered as an outpatient. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's also difficult. We see this pretty frequently with lab and studies where there's handoff issues if there's a large delay when the result is going to return. And sometimes things fall through the crack. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I don't want to be the bad guy and discourage and cancel lab tests. That's not what any of the pathologists want to do. But our goal is to, if I hear that it's going to affect inpatient management and we're going to get the test back within 7 days, I'm going to feel like I can approve the test, which is great. I just wanted to make sure that, again, another point is that the pathologists in our group in Mountain Air Pathology are available for a phone call, and we love to discuss the clinical scenario and how this test is going to be used. And I just want to stress, as a consultant, we're available, and we're definitely available for these tests that fall under the review tier. And so the next tier was restricted. The restricted category is tests that do not typically impact inpatient medicine. We don't want to deny anyone that test. And some labs fall under the restricted tier, which simply means that they're not viewed to impact inpatient medicine. Examples of these would be, Huntington disease gene mutation panel. I mean, that's not something that needs to be done in the inpatient setting, or factor V Leiden gene mutation. A lot of genetic testing can wait for the outpatient world. And then there's some tests that are non-formulary, which means they're completely unavailable. The bleeding test the bleeding time is a test that's just not available. It doesn't need to be done.
I'm a little bit curious too about one issue you previously indicated was an issue around transfusions of plasma to correct laboratory values. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So one of the tests on the choosing wisely of the 35 tests the ASCP put together is, don't transfuse plasma to correct a laboratory value. Treat the clinical status of the patient. So plasma transfusion to a patient with an INR of less than 1.6 has minimal effect. And transfusion for INR values between 1.6 and 2 should be considered carefully. And this is all because a mildly elevated INR is usually not associated with spontaneous hemorrhage and doesn't increase the risk of bleeding during routine invasive procedures. And then we want to cut down on use or administration of expensive blood products because, first of all, they're expensive, but also there's always a risk for a transfusion reaction, transfusion-related illness, and you know, an allergic transfusion reaction. And so that's kind of the logic there around just being mindful of plasma administration.
Yeah. I know that, you know, when I trained, it was pretty common to transfuse 2 units, and it was just automatic. And, you know, I know that's not the case anymore. And obviously, even people with very low hemoglobins, if they're clinically doing okay, we can watch them and make sure that they're progressing normally and don't always need a transfusion. So I'm assuming a lot of this stuff, as you mentioned, you know, I'm not working on the hospital side anymore. It sounds like they're embedded into the standing orders and into the order sets that kind of guide that decision support that are needed by clinicians working in the hospital. Is that true for transfused blood products as well?
It doesn't fall into the tiers like in the laboratory formulary as far as ordering blood products. And I think we do a good job in the blood bank of educating the most common users of blood products about our transfusion thresholds, if you will, for various CBC indices. That's kind of how that is done. And we also have a blood utilization review committee where we look at, you know, thousands of instances of transfused blood, and we go back and try to make sure they're appropriate. And the hospital does an excellent job of making sure that blood is transfused appropriately.
So I have another question. So we are a network that extends beyond the Mission Health System. So, you know, some of the people listening to this podcast may work at Pardee, or they may work at with Erlanger. Do you have a sense of the work going on region-wide, or any recommendations related to hospital providers who may be working in other systems? Is there the ability to access this information somewhere online that they could go find some resources to support their choosing wisely, or kind of better processes in terms of making sure they're ordering according to guidelines?
Yes, the choosing wisely through the ASCP is an easy document to get a hold of. Again, it's put together by an expert panel. It's pretty well agreed upon. Yeah, it has tons of references. I think it's kind of a gold mine for if any hospital system wanted to work on being better laboratory stewards. I think this would be a great place to start, and then you can expand upon it as you see fit.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We look forward to talking more. We will add a link to this resource onto MHP Connect if you're interested. So what's the best way to contact a pathologist with Mountain Area Pathology?
I would just, if it's a Mission Health related question, I would call the pathology lab. Our offices, it's 828-213-0957, and just say you'd like to speak to any one of us.
Great. That sounds perfect. Okay. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you more, and I hope everybody enjoyed this podcast.